Good morning. Not only will you never guess a text, you get three texts for the price of one this morning. And we should be... My first text is from Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 to 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge. Neither shall you gather the gleaning after your harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyard bare. Neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. And for our second text. And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to the edge, nor shall you gather its gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. And from Deuteronomy 24, 19 to 21. When you reap your harvest in your fields and forget a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back and get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat your olive trees, you shall not go over them again. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. When you gather the grapes of your vineyard, you shall not strip it afterwards. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow. So as you know, last year, a publisher in the US released my commentary on the Book of Ruth. A somewhat different commentary, it certainly is. Now this is the second of four sermons, each dealing with a chapter of the book. I'm preaching in 2 weeks' time, and it deals with the midnight on the threshing field. It has adult content. Can't avoid it. So again, we're trying to fit 50 pages of this commentary into roughly 20 minutes. There isn't a single theme today. Sandwich, 3 points, doesn't work like that. I'm just going to pick up some largely unrelated areas that might be easily overlooked. When Ruth asked her mother-in-law if she could go gleaning, Naomi was still in deep depression. But there was finally a kind word for Ruth after her stony silence at the end of chapter 1. Yet she doesn't even tell Ruth how to stay safe or that she'd be likely to get a better reception from a virtuous family member. So out Ruth goes, left totally to her own devices, to glean instead of sitting at home to starve. Now there's a practice that's called sinicide, which is the killing of the elderly, or just simply abandoning them to die. In times past, in hard times, occasionally the Inuit would do this to their elderly. And they weren't the only culture to do this. You didn't survive long in a blizzard. For the community to survive in a bad season, scarce resources were needed for the fit and for the healthy. What value was Naomi to a society that lived only a little above the subsistence level? She was too old to give it more sons, and it appears that she was too old to work. Surely she and women like her were just a drain on the resources in good times and an impossible drain in times of famine. The story of Ruth is really the story of Naomi, the pleasant one, of how she went out from Bethlehem full, with the security of her husband and her two boys, yet she faced the bitterness of the dark night of her soul following their deaths. The story doesn't end there, but in chapter 4, with a son that is born to Naomi, not Ruth, a son who refreshes her soul and returns her name, the Pleasant One. But still, a child was another non-productive mouth to feed. And in the middle is the care of another non-productive member of society, scavenging its offcasts. Other than being a potential plaything for young men, Ruth has apparently nothing she can contribute, but is also a drain on resources. Despite being married for some time, she was childless, and a farmer needed a wife that could produce sons simply to live into old age. Our government has allowed society to see the unborn as objects to be destroyed at will. The more so it appears if they are female. As for the elderly, where will that end? I'm very thankful that my Medicare card no longer says expiry date as it used to. No, it's changed. It says valid too. But Ruth has as its very core the powerful message that we are to see value in all human life, the productive and the unproductive, the worthy and the unworthy, the defenseless and the strong. Did you notice how two of those verses in my texts that I read from Leviticus ended with, "I am the Lord"? These are the opening words of the Ten Commandments, God's covenant with Israel, and they are shorthand for it. The provisions for gleaning was meant to be linked to what they are supposed to be as a spiritual, worshipping and blessed people. Still, it would be easy to say that gleaning is just an historical curiosity from the Bronze Age with no application to modern Australian society and should be left just there. After all, when Moses gave instructions about providing for the poor through gleaning, he could never have imagined occupational health and safety. Now, you wouldn't dare have a stranger on your field while you've got the machinery there when you're harvesting. And what about farm hygiene? This person could have been on the other side of a country a week ago. You wouldn't dare do it. And Centrelink, of course, changes everything. Theoretically, there's no need for somebody to starve to death in this country. The harvesting regulations were different from the other laws in that obedience could not be measured or weighed. Was it 1 cubit, 2 cubits, 3 cubits that they couldn't harvest from the edge? That's because fundamentally it was an act of worship. How much of my harvest can I trust to God? It was an understanding that my prosperity does not come from my frugality, but by God's blessing upon my generosity. Reg told me about a practice you had here some time ago, which was God's acre, which was in much the same vein. Let me just say a little bit about that picture. Last sermon I spoke about Horatio Spafford and his wonderful hymn, "Is Well With My Soul," and how his church would not allow him his integrity in his suffering. He and some others moved to Jerusalem and established what was known as the American Colony. And there they provided soup kitchen charity for Muslim, Christian and Jew alike. very, very generous and without regard of religion or person. And he won the respect in that community that he lacked in Chicago amongst Christians. They set up a photographic division and they reenacted the story of Ruth on a plot of land that is believed to be that of Boaz's. The foreigner who followed foreign gods could well be considered less moral and certainly would easily be seen as less deserving than an upright Jewish woman who had fallen on hard times. The Lord had commanded them to love the foreigner like themselves. Now, we could make all manner of excuse for not supporting such people, but God would have no part of it, and Boaz would have no part of it. There was no favoritism. One thing the laws on gleaning teach us, and Boaz demonstrates to us, is that there is no distinction between church on Sunday and our business. The old man went to his fields, diligent and focused, to ensure that his desire to worship God through providing for the poor was carried out, and his charity was not cold. Ruth, for her part, set out aimlessly that morning, and it appears that she was sent packing from other fields till finally her chance chanced upon the field of Boaz, so the Hebrew says. Our translations usually play down the element of luck, but one commentator uses sheer luck for these two words. And he adds it is as shocking in Hebrew as it is in his translation. And it's shocking for the Christian also. And let's be honest, if it was luck, Ruth's luck hadn't been that good up to that point. But luck didn't end there. She just happened to be at the right field at the right time when the godly owner turned up. And luck didn't start that day, because that very field had come to Boaz's father by the casting of lots. And it didn't end there, as we'll see again in the next two chapters. Again, we are introduced to the ambiguity of Ruth. The intentionality of Ruth meets the complete randomness of Ruth's wandering. She hoped for only one thing that day, to find favour in the sight of someone to allow her to do what was hers by right. Was it chance or was it providence? The storyteller asks you to make up your own mind, and not just about Ruth, but about your own life. Has it been chance or has it been providence? This church has a book of testimonies called So Much Blood. And to our visitors, I haven't got a copy to give you, unfortunately. There are some great testimonies in that book. And you'll read in that book of the time when, as a young man, Barry's jumper got tangled up in the potato harvester and the engine of the tractor just happened to stop. Was it chance or was it providence? Some will praise God for a miracle. Others will say, Barry, you should have gone out and bought a casket ticket because it's your lucky day. Far better than winning the casket will be how you answer that question. Luck or providence? Or whether you have discovered that the steps of a good man or a woman are ordered by the Lord and that he delights in them. I started this sermon with three passages from the law of Moses, but I could have added another, Leviticus 19:31-34, which says, the stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. It comes with the same solemn reference to the covenant with Israel. I am the Lord your God. There is a saying that you don't send a boy to do a man's job. So here we have an overseer with a responsible role, dishonoured by the storyteller calling him a lad. How do we see this command to love foreigners worked out here in this field of Bethlehem? You see, the overseer has a lot to say to Boaz, and it's all critical. He told him that Ruth is a Moabitess, hinting that she doesn't really belong there. By changing just one word in her request, she asked for permission to glean among the sheaves. He said she asked permission to glean from the stalks, something she had no right to do. This makes her sound greedy and presumptuous without directly saying so. Then he says that Ruth has been standing since morning. Gleaners do not stand, they move. They follow the harvesters. They sit and they glean. Why then does the overseer say that Ruth has been standing all day? Perhaps he's hinting that he has ordered her to stand and wait until the master arrives and decides whether to give her permission to glean or not. In three brief sentences, the overseer has put Ruth down, shown off his ability to keep unworthy strangers out, all without quite saying a single explicit negative word about her. One Jewish commentator said that we should learn to see this overseer as a bigot who dislikes strangers. To which I would add, it's a very big deal not to let her drink from the water jars. And that, above everything, shows what was going on there. Strictly, Boaz doesn't bless Ruth. He blesses his workers when he arrives. But here he is more thoughtful. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. We spoke about that last week. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. The enormity of what she has done, leaving the security of what she had in Moab for what can only be expected as poverty and hardship because of her love for a mother-in-law, is not lost on this man of substance. In fact, here she is presented as someone greater than Abraham. Abraham left his mother and father for another country, but with great wealth. And here she does the same for abject poverty, for love. A greater than Abraham. In coming weeks, we will see that the vague prayer for blessing is given real substance as he goes out and does for Ruth with his own hands the request that he has sent up for heaven. But that's months away in Ruth's life, and a wedding is not on anyone's mind yet. He is just a gracious old man who is kind to one of his relatives. But did you notice, even now, the very thing that Boaz asked God to do, he does himself. He will make sure that she doesn't go home empty-handed, hungry, or thirsty. So where is God in all this? There are no visions, no dreams, no angels, no voices from heaven, no miracles. But the Almighty's hand is at work. And it is at work in the same way as we know it here in this farming community. And we can see it clearly through the eyes of faith. Before Boaz knew who the stranger was in his fields, The young men were instructed not to molest her. Three times Boaz urges Ruth not to leave the safety of his fields. Had something already happened? But Boaz and Naomi guide Ruth into the virtuous ways of a Jewish woman. It is never judgmental or done with censure. Boaz told her, don't make eye contact with the reapers, these young men that he didn't trust. Stay with the young women. At lunch, she sat with the reapers, and Boaz calls her over to him and shows her special favour. And that set a line in the sand for the others. When Boaz returned to Naomi, she said that the landholder said, you shall keep close to my young men until they have finished all my harvest. But her mother-in-law corrects her. Stay with the women, lest you get hurt. And Ruth finally gets the message. My dear friends, it is my earnest desire that this church will be blessed with the conversion of sinners who will need guidance in how to live virtuous life. God forbid that we would ever be judgmental, especially with someone whose life is in transition. Instead, may our attitudes always be loving and kind, like that of Boaz and Naomi. Sometimes we need to be remembered. Sometimes we need to remember that Boaz's mother, Rahab, a hero of the faith, did not have a sign outside her door that said washing, ironing, and mending. Would the Lord trust us with such a person? Would they find love and acceptance in this place? Ruth returned to Naomi blissfully ignorant of what happened on that barley field. But alarm bells rang for Naomi. Gleaners aren't given food, and they certainly can't glean the amount of grain that she did. If eaten frugally, Ruth brought enough food for 20 to 25 days for them both. Whose field did you work in, and what did you do? Naomi's questioning is full of sexual undertones. But Ruth doesn't reply what, but who. This stranger was a man completely above suspicion, their close relative, a potential deliverer from their hopeless situation. That's my tombstone. Bit sobering, but yes, one day, hopefully not too soon, some of you may gather there. May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living and the dead. Whose kindness has not forsaken the dead men in her life? Was it God's or Boaz's? The storyteller is ambiguous, and intentionally so. Naomi's husband and sons lay in a grave in Moab, loved, mourned, but dead. And what hope do the dead have who can no longer enjoy the good things that God pours out in this world? And the Old Testament is very unclear about what happens after death. Consider, for in death there is no remembrance of you. In Sheol, who can give you praise? Or, I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like those who have no help. Our storyteller asks us to decide. Does God's loving kindness end in a shroud under 6 foot of earth? And then he moves on to the next generation? Or is it eternal? Or is it just us who are to be kind to the widows? And of course, it could just as accurately be both. But for me, the grave has lost its sting. It has been sanctified by the presence of our Father's Son and our Saviour, whose mercy endures forever. If there is one theme that comes through most of what I have drawn from chapter 2, it is that we are to see value in those that the society says we are to ignore or even despise. These are the very people that should receive our kindness and our love, not as cold charity, but as an act of worship. Amen. And at this stage, I'll hand over to Dale.